You're listening to Let's Talk Creation with Todd Wood and Paul Garner, the creation show where we learn, grow, and worship.
Well, welcome back for another episode of Let's Talk Creation with Paul Garner and Todd Wood. I'm Paul Garner.
And I'm Todd Wood.
Don't forget to like and share our episodes, tell your friends about us, all of that good stuff. And if you like what we're doing with the podcast, do consider making a donation to support us. You can go to letstalkcreation.org. And you can find out all the information about how to do that there. Now, I've been looking forward to this episode, Todd. We're going to do something slightly different today. We're going to be thinking about the extent of Noah's flood, whether the flood was local or global. And we decided to do this sort of in response to a video that was posted recently by a Christian apologist who many people will know. Called Gavin Ortlund on his YouTube channel. Now, just to introduce Gavin, until recently, Gavin was senior pastor of First Baptist Church in Ojai, California, but he now runs his own apologetics ministry called Truth Unites, on which he sort of devotes a lot of time to interacting with Catholic apologists and others, as well as promoting sort of his own ideas about theological triage. You know, how do we decide what theological hills are worth dying on and which are not? Some of our viewers may be aware that recently Gavin has also been posting some videos about the creation evolution issue, particularly concerning the age of the earth. And one of his recent videos was a biblical defense of the local flood position. And then there was a kind of follow-up video as well where he sort of responded to some of his sort of online critics. And we've not really done this before, but we thought it was worth sort of interacting with some of this a bit. Now, you know, we're not a debate channel. That's not really what we're kind of about. And so this isn't going to be a direct response, if you like, to Gavin Ortlund per se, but rather an examination of what we what you might think of as the conundrum of the flood.
Yeah.
And I'll explain what we sort of mean by that as we go along. And then we'll sort of follow that with an explanation of how both the local flood and the global flood explanations seek to resolve this conundrum. And then, and so what we'll do basically is we'll try to give as positive a case for the local flood position as we can. That case is a little bit different to the case that Gavin makes, but we're going to try and sort of make an argument for the local flood position, but then also sort of explain what we think some of the problems with that position are. And we're going to address in particular some of the specific points that Gavin talks about in his videos sort of towards the end. So that's kind of where we're going with this. So it's sort of, slightly different to what we're used to doing.
And I should say here, we got a lot of requests when that video went up about the local flood, when Gavin's video went up about the local flood. And I have steadfastly resisted doing response videos since we started. I'm a guy who thinks, you know, this back and forth sniping on YouTube is just tiresome and annoying, and I don't care. You're trying to make me care about your little squabbles, and I don't care. And it's soul draining. And so I've not really wanted to do this. Even this video I didn't want to do. But honestly, the more I thought about it, the more I thought,
I had to twist your arm, right? So
it's not just that, but the local flood question is really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, if Let's Talk Creation is all about learn, grow, and worship, we're going to learn really cool things if we actually stop and talk about the local flood. So like you say, this is an episode that is, let's call it inspired by Gavin Ortlund and not necessarily just a direct rebuttal, although we will do some response stuff at the end. But
yeah.
So the challenge I see here going into this, and this has kind of frustrated me for years, and it's not just Gavin. And frankly, I don't really even know I don't really follow Gavin's ministry, so I don't really know much about his work, but I see a lot of people that I engage with are willing to sort of address the questions of the text that the text raises about science in very simple ways that do not survive deep examination. Let's put it that way. And I understand that a lot of these positions that people hold and advocate are positions that they're extremely personal. They are addressing a particular question or anxiety that that person has, and it does whatever it is that they've come up with addresses those questions for their own sake, even though it may not be generally applicable. Let's put it that way. And I think this question of the local flood is one of those questions where I feel like the harder I look into this, the more the local flood idea just doesn't really cohere. It doesn't hold together. And it doesn't really work. But getting people to actually engage with questions of archaeology, questions of geology, questions of the text itself, all of those things, you get people who are experts in one of those areas, but they're just not really that interested in going deep. So I guess our episode here is going to be unique in that way. And yeah. So conundrum of the flood.
Yeah.
I want to say before you say that, I want to say one more time, we are not targeting Gavin Ortlund. If you're a Gavin Ortlund fan, good for you. I hope God blesses you through his work. And I mean that genuinely and sincerely and honestly. We're not here to pick on people. I'm not trying to pick a fight. I'm just making some general observations about how these things have gone and what it means for this particular issue. Paul, conundrum of the flood. What do you got?
Before I come to that, I mean, I just want to reiterate what you said. I have watched some of Gavin's videos, and I like his demeanor. I think he's a cordial guy. You know, he interacts well with people that he disagrees with. He's very likable. I've benefited from some of his videos. So none of this, you know, is kind of an attack on Gavin Ortlund. I want to make that absolutely clear. It would be great to have a kind of cordial discussion with Gavin about some of these questions, because topics like this can get heated so quickly. As you say, you know, it can descend into this, the darker corners of the internet, and you can see all of this kind of fighting and stuff. And I think, like Gavin, we have a concern for Christians to be able to talk about things like this that they disagree with, and to do that in a reasonable, cordial way. So that's kind of what we want to try and achieve with this. So the conundrum of the flood. I suppose we should start with, why do we think that the Bible describes a global flood? Because I think a very strong case can be made for this. There are lots of things to say, and I'll try to be brief, because we could easily spend a whole episode, you know, and we probably will in our Creationism 101 series, you know, on this. So why do we think that the Bible sort of, at least at face value, describes a worldwide flood? Well, firstly, there's the stated purpose of the flood. For example, in Genesis 6, verse 7, we read, "I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens." And we see something similar in Genesis 7, verse 4, where we read that every living thing that I've made, I will blot out from the face of the ground. And it seems, at least on the face of it, that purpose for the flood could only be achieved if the flood was universal. And I want you to note particularly that blotting out includes not only the people, but also the animals. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's one thing. And then, of course, there are texts like Genesis 6, verse 13, where God says, "I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them." And of course, to understand what God means by all flesh, we need to look in context. And in Genesis 7, verse 21, all flesh is defined for us because we're told that all flesh died that moved on the earth. Birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and the people. So all flesh includes, again, the people and the animals. And it's all flesh that appears to be described as violent and corrupt before the flood. And then we've got this issue of the size and the provision of the ark. You know, the ark is absolutely massive, as we know. We've already talked about that in a previous episode. And again, you know, why would you need an ark for a local flood? On the face of it, it seems unnecessary, given that Noah and the animals could have escaped the flood simply by sort of relocating or moving to higher ground or to the next valley or whatever it is. Right. So there's that. And then, of course, we've got the description of the flood itself, the 40 days and nights of rain, a description of a massive flood, you know, unlike anything in our experience. That the fact that all the high mountains under the whole heaven are covered, and it's hard to see how all the high mountains, even in one local region, could be covered by a local flood, even a large regional flood. And then there's this, you know, as you read the text, as you read through Genesis 6 to 9, you're struck by the multiple use of universal terms. You know, it's like the author is emphasizing this, that you can't miss the point. And of course, this is what Hebrew does, doesn't it? Hebrew writers use repetition to emphasize points. This is what they do. And so the case here isn't that it rests on a single word or verse or one single expression, but the fact that we have this cumulative use of universal terms, all, every, only. And of course, this universality is stated in different ways. It's stated positively, everything died, but it's also stated negatively, only Noah and those on the ark were saved. So we have this sort of positive negative way of expressing the same truths. It's also significant that the post-flood promises are couched in the same universal language that the flood itself is described. We have God's promise, of course, never again to send a flood that will destroy all flesh or destroy the earth. And I think a legitimate question is if the flood was local, has that promise been violated? Mm-hmm. But then we've also got the post-flood covenant that God makes with Noah, the animals on the ark, and their descendants. And we apply that covenant sort of universally. But of course, if there were people or animals that were not affected by the flood, then that obviously becomes problematic. And then if we turn to the New Testament, we have this portrayal of the flood, particularly in a passage like 2 Peter chapter 3, where the flood is sort of the counterpoint to the original creation and the new creation. We have the original creation being undone by the flood. The waters again covering the earth like they did in the beginning. You know, this is a reversal of creation. And then we have a new world that emerges after the flood. And of course, this points forward to the new heavens and the new earth that is going to come when Jesus returns. And it's hard to see how the flood can be anything other than coextensive with the original creation and the new creation when you read a passage like that. And then just two more points very briefly. We also have to reckon with the fact that the pre-modern interpretation was that the flood was universal with respect to the globe. Now, there may have been the odd exception, but generally speaking, if you look at across the witness of church history, they are exceptions. Most people seem to accept that the flood was universal. And in both Old and New Testaments, it's also interesting that we have unique words used to describe the flood. Both in Hebrew, we have the word mabul. In Greek, we have kataklysmos. And both of these words are used only of the flood, arguably perhaps, but they seem to be used only of the flood, suggesting that these were unique events. So I think there's a very strong cumulative case, at least at face value, to say that the flood was worldwide. So, Todd, take us on.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think once again, I'm impressed by this is not just taking the text literally or something like that. Right. This is, you know, there's lots of ways to read through the text and say, yeah, this really does that. And the thing that really clinches it for me, or at least impresses me maybe more than others, is that notion of those repetitious universal words. If I were, say, a pre-modern person who did not have a developed concept or even a word for planet or globe, and I wanted to communicate to you that the flood covered the planet or the globe, that's how I'd do it, right? Everything died. Everything everywhere under the face of heaven died. Everything that had the breath of life died. The flood covered everything. The flood covered the whole land. It covered all the earth. I would just keep repeating that until you got the sense of, okay, so he's not talking about a river overflowing its banks. He means this flood covered everything. So that strikes me as quite important, because that's exactly what you see in the text. And I encourage our readers, go read Genesis 7, because you will see those universals. It's like hammer blows on an anvil. Wham, 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 just one after the other.
Yeah.
And it's not always the same one. They vary the whole thing, the way that those words are used. Now, that does lead us up to the conundrum of the flood. And the conundrum has been, you know, how exactly do you relate this notion of a global flood to the physical evidence that we see around us, right? Now, early speculations, and this is tricky because there's a lot going into this, but there's early speculations that sort of the fossils that we see, the things that we understand as fossils, were deposited by the flood. That's not universal, but there are speculations along that line. As geology developed and began to recognize the geologic column, then people began to think that, okay, well, there's been a series of floods, essentially, a series of cataclysms, and that only the most recent one was the flood described in the Bible. That makes that flood to be the sort of uppermost layers of debris and rock. And a guy named Buckland, you might remember Mr. Buckland.
Yes.
Yeah.
William Buckland,
yes. There you go. He associated the flood with this pretty well-known set of superficial kind of debris deposits from Europe and North America. They called these actually diluvium, right? So diluvium relating to diluvial, which is a word describing flood. So these were called diluvium, and he just assumed that this must be the remains of the global flood. But here in the United States, Agassiz came along, Louis Agassiz, and began to study these this diluvium, and in particular made a very influential expedition around Lake Superior. And he came to the conclusion that the diluvium was really the remnants of glaciers that had melted away. And not, in fact, the debris from the flood. So that sort of set up the problem, right? So you have the initial idea that the flood made the fossils, which was some speculation. And then came the old age idea that came along with the geologic column that basically said the flood is the most recent thing and that the lower layers are caused by something else. And then you have Buckland, who says, it must be this diluvium here on the surface, which sure looks like it's water transported catastrophic debris. And then you have Agassiz, who says, nope, It's not that. It's that debris is comes from glaciers, and there was a time at which glaciers covered Europe and North America. Now, in the modern world, we pick up this story, and we now have super impressive digital maps of the globe, including topographic information, which tells us how far above and below sea level things are. And we have very good measurements of how much water there is on the planet. And so we can actually go in digitally and figure out, all right, if we converted all the water on the planet from ice into liquid water, what would that do to the planet? And what you find is it does not flood the planet that we're living on, which I think should come as some surprise to all of us Bible believers. We would think that if you doused the world in completely liquid water, that it would everything would die and the whole face of the heaven would be covered and so forth. But apparently there's not enough water to do that. So, for example, in North America, you lose the eastern seaboard. The coastline would go inland to around the middle of Alabama, the middle of Georgia, so forth. So that would happen. In Europe, London and Cambridge go underwater. Sorry, Paul. But apparently Manchester, Birmingham, and all of Wales remain, the Lake District, they all remain above sea level. Continental Europe, you lose Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. The Caspian Sea would connect to the Black Sea. Africa is essentially the same. Africa doesn't really change much. South America, you have massive inlets of sea at the Amazon Basin and down in Paraguay. And then in Asia, you get a lot of eastern China underwater. And then in Australia, there's some really big lakes called Lake Torrens, which is in the south. I don't know that I've said that right. Sorry, Australians. But that joins up to a massive inlet of the sea as well. But otherwise, the ground is still exposed. There's a huge amount of ground still exposed. And I'm going to make sure we link to that that particular National Geographic site there that shows you what happens when all the water goes into goes from being ice to water. And so you can check out if your town would be flooded in that scenario, too. So that's the conundrum, right? I mean, that's essentially the conundrum. Where did the evidence of the flood go? And one way of handling this, that is perhaps the easiest way of handling it, is to say, all right, well, the science has shown that there was no global flood, and that indeed there could be no global flood. And therefore, the story of the flood in Genesis is some sort of narrative theological device. And we might say it's rooted in the ancient Near Eastern stories, similar stories of the flood in the ancient Near East and so forth. And I think, yeah, there's still a lot of evangelical scholars out there who I think would be very uncomfortable with that reaction. So, okay, so there's the conundrum. Where did the evidence of the flood go? Why isn't it obvious to us? Paul?
Yeah.
How do we young age creationists deal with this? What do we come up with that answers this yeah. challenge?
Sure. So the young age creationist response to this is to say, we've underestimated the flood and its physical evidence. The scriptural evidence that I kind of very briefly summarized at the beginning of this episode seems very compelling. It does look as if the Bible really wants us to understand that the flood was worldwide, you know, and that it covered the whole planet. And so the young age creationist response to this is to say, well, the flood as we've imagined it in the past is simply too small. What we really need to be looking for is a flood that could reshape the whole surface of the planet. It's got to be a giant tectonic event, because it's got to completely sort of reformat the surface of the earth. It's got to produce mountains and It's got to change the depth of the ocean basins. It's got to lay down, you know, huge deposits of sediment on the newly formed continents and so on. So what we say is you've got to zoom out and think much bigger about the flood than we've thought before. In fact, that the flood that I think we envisage as young age creationists is so awful, truly terrible, that if God had not remembered Noah, as the biblical text tells us, then nothing would have survived, not even those on the ark. So that would be our response. Now, of course, there are drawbacks to that position, which, you know, we're familiar with, because what it means is that lots of geological evidence needs to be reinterpreted. And that's an enormous challenge. You know, this is a huge endeavor that we're talking about here. This is not a small sort of rethinking of the scientific evidence. And I think it's fair to say we haven't been shy about pointing out that we need to do this. We need to rethink everything. Where are the flood sediments? You know, where do we see them in the rock record? Which rocks might be deposited before the flood or during the flood or after the flood? What does the fossil record mean? How do we interpret it in this context of the flood? What about all the radiometric dates? You know, we've got a series going on radiometric dating. What do those dates mean if they're not telling us about a very old Earth? What about those crustal rearrangements and the production of mountains and changing, you know, the shape and depth of ocean basins? How do we do that? How did these rapid sort of crustal rearrangements happen? Where did all the heat go? I mean, this is a big question. If you compress all of this geological activity into a short period of time, you generate lots of heat. What happened to that heat? So we're not unaware that there are enormous challenges and difficulties to this position. But I think our response would be to say the Bible is clear, the text is clear, and what it means is we've got to think very differently about the scientific evidence. So that's how we would respond. What about the local flood response? How would you kind of make an argument for that, given the conundrum that we've sort of set out at the beginning of this episode?
Yeah, so I want to just first of all agree with you. You're absolutely right. I've always, you know, when I've taught origins courses to churches or whatever, or spoken on this issue, I've always said plate tectonics is the most important discovery that we ever made, because now we have a mechanism whereby you can lower the mountains, raise the seabed, and actually create a global flood, because we don't have enough water to do that otherwise. So, yeah, really important. And that means we have vastly underestimated the scale of the flood. It's just huge. It's huge almost beyond comprehending. We have no analogy for it in the world. So, all right. So the other option, of course, to the conundrum of the flood is that we are going to localize it. We're going to say, for example, perhaps Genesis is not describing the flood as a truly global thing, but simply it destroyed the world of Noah, which encases a large amount of the land, okay? So maybe even a shockingly, unprecedentedly large amount of land, but it was not across the planet. But it was enough, and this is the other important part, it was enough to kill all the people. So it's universal to human beings, but it's not universal to the entire planet. Now, before I get into this, there's a couple things I want to say. One is this is not, I have not borrowed anybody else's version of the local flood model. This is Todd Wood's interpretation. This is Todd Wood's best estimate of what the local flood model ought to be. And it is not my position. Before my detractors get all excited that I'm about to tip my hand, no, I don't believe what I'm about to say. I'm playing the other side, trying to give them the best that I can come up with. So, all right. So, could you understand this in a local fashion? And there's there are some reasons why you might do this. So not just because of the conundrum of the flood, but for example, the universal words that we see in this text are used hyperbolically in other passages, meaning that they are used in a way that means it's kind of exaggerated. So let's say, Paul, that I went to a church picnic and I told you everybody was there. You would understand that. You would not understand that to mean literally, you know, King Charles was there and Harrison Ford was there. And no, you would understand that when I say everyone was there, I'm probably talking about my church. And you might even say, I don't necessarily mean everyone on the actual membership roll of my church, because I don't carry that around with me and check off as I notice. Maybe I just mean there's a lot of people there that I recognize, and it was really crowded at my church picnic, right? So yeah. It is natural in the way we talk to use these hyperbolic terms to mean this is really big or this is really amazing, and not to mean this woodenly literal notion that these things must be universal. And as I mentioned, you know, we have passages in the Bible where we think this is probably hyperbolic. There we oftentimes see reference to all the world doing something in the Bible. All the world comes to Egypt to buy grain in the time of Joseph. All the world comes to festivals in Jerusalem, for example. And we know it does not mean, you know, the Maori in New Zealand came over to the, no. We understand what it means. It means just a lot of people from a lot of places. Okay, so we got to be careful reading these universals. We also notice, as we look into the archaeology of Mesopotamia, and this comes up quite a lot, that there are evidences of really large flooding events that deposit huge, huge chunks of clay and sand and so forth. So there are these archaeological candidates for what the flood might be. It's not that we're just saying, maybe it's a local thing. No, there are layers that might well be these sorts of things. And of course, there are other people who have proposed other ideas about where the flood might have taken place, the original flood that inspired the biblical story. And we would also mention those other ancient Near Eastern texts. Now, we mentioned this already. So there are other stories, for example, the Utnapishtim story. That's a great word. I love saying that, Utnapishtim. there are flood stories in the ancient Near East that are not the Israelite version. And so maybe everybody there is remembering a time when there was this massive flood that destroyed a lot of stuff. And so they all have their version of the story. And, you know, the biblical version is sort of the consecrated theological version, and everybody else is sort of this corrupted pagan myth. And we would emphasize here the setting here in Mesopotamia, because, you know, Genesis describes Eden by describing the Tigris and Euphrates rivers as part of the geographic setting of Eden. So if you were to want to destroy the pre-flood people, well, it makes sense that they would be around this region of Eden. So what we would understand it then to be is if some kind of localized but gigantic inundation of Mesopotamia that wiped out all those people that lived there since creation. And that's what Noah's seeing. When Noah looks out of the ark and he can't see anything but water as far as the eye can see, he's describing it in terms of this global disaster. But it isn't global to, you know, the entire planet. And the advantage of this position, in my mind, would be that you don't have to reinvent geology, right, Paul? I mean, your position right. basically requires us to go back to geology and go, wow, a lot of this is going to have to be reinterpreted and a lot of this must be mistaken. You know, local flood, you don't have to do that, right? You can essentially accept the timeline. You can be an old earth person and still have a real historical flood that is really universal to human beings. And so we don't have to, we can live with geology and we can live with what the Bible says. It sounds like a win-win, right?
Sure.
So that's a real advantage. Now, drawbacks to this position, because of course, as I mentioned, this is not my position. I am merely trying to give the best version of it that I can come up with. But the drawbacks, I think this is already a poor fit with the way the text describes things. I've already mentioned this notion of repetition. It is not simply a matter of hyperbole, right? If I told you that there was a flood that covered the whole earth, I'm sure that your first response would be, what, the whole earth? Because you're immediately thinking he must be speaking hyperbolically. He must be using an exaggeration because that's how we use language. And then I go back and I say, no, I mean, the flood covered the whole land. It covered everything. Everything everywhere died. Everything that had the breath of life died. Humans and animals, everything died. All the creeping things, the wild animals, the birds, they all died. You would get the sense that, okay, he's not being hyperbolic. He really means that this covered the planet. So I already think this is not a very good fit to the biblical text. Now, archaeologically, there are these big river flood deposits, true enough, but I am not aware of any that have been correlated regionally, right? If you think that there is a massive flood such that Noah got in his ark with all of his animals and he could not see anything on the horizon that was land, that's a big flood. That's a geographically extensive flood. And so I don't know... it would have to encompass many different city-states in the Mesopotamian region, and I am unaware of a flood that correlates across that much space, right? So even though you might point to one city that had a big flood that destroyed it, I'm not sure that you can point to a lot of places in the region. And I think this is a really interesting topic, and we're already making notes for another episode because I think the whole notion of Mesopotamian floods is really interesting, and we should look into that. And then I just find the geography to be somewhat questionable. And this is another one of those points where you might say, well, maybe the local flood happened in some other geographic region. Okay, that could be fair. You could weasel out of it that way, or wiggle out of it that way. Let's not be mean. At the same time, yeah, the geography of Eden is so odd. There's a river that flows out of Eden that separates into four different rivers, and two of the rivers are the Tigris and the Euphrates. And that's not what happens. And frankly, geographically, we don't really have any place like that in the modern world. Rivers don't divide, they join. They join together as the drainage begins to reach the sea. The more and more streams and more branches of the river join up into one big channel that then empties into the ocean. This is speaking of something that's really quite different. So I don't, you know, they're using the names, sure, but it doesn't really match the geography. So, okay, so that's my reaction to this. That's my best case. And that's to me the conundrum of the flood, right? Where are we going to find, if we really believe that the flood really happened, where are we going to find this physical evidence that it left behind? And the creationist says, it's everywhere. You missed it because you're looking too small. You need to look bigger. Yeah. And the local flood guy says, nah, we don't need to do that much disruption to science. And we can just see that the Bible is speaking hyperbolically. And it's just the local area. Now, so let's talk about Gavin Ortlund. And again, we're falling all over ourselves here, but we're not, this is not a shot across the bow. We're not trying to attack anybody. We're not trying to question his Christian faith or his orthodoxy or his commitment to evangelical faith or anything like that. We're just going to examine the things he thinks or the proposals that he put forward about this local flood. So why don't you start us off, Paul?
Yeah, so let's think about some of the points that Gavin sort of makes in his videos. And the first one that he wants to emphasize is that a local flood doesn't mean a small flood. So he's trying to emphasize, you know, that, and I guess this is to sort of mollify people who think that a local flood can't be
right
the big flood that's described in the Bible. So he's saying, no, local doesn't have to mean small. It can mean unprecedentedly large, but still not covering the whole earth. And I think there are some problems with that. One is, as you've already said, that if it was not small, if it was a large flood, but it was contained within the confines of the lower Mesopotamian basin, then there's essentially no evidence for it. We do have, as you've mentioned, so these local flood layers in various cities. As far as I'm aware, they don't all correlate with one another. They are of different ages. They're small individual events. They're not evidence of one single sort of very large event in that area. And although Gavin is he's somewhat sort of equivocal about exactly what he thinks, you know, the event was that gave rise to the biblical flood story. He does talk about the Black Sea flood. You know, that's another sort of, you know, scenario that people have put forward. I think there are some problems with that as well, not least that the Black Sea basin kind of filled with fresh water actually rather too slowly.
Yes.
It would have been easy to escape from the Black Sea flood at a reasonable walking pace.
Yes.
And in fact, we know that many people were not killed by the Black Sea flood. They were merely displaced from where they were living.
Yep.
And of course, the other thing about the Black Sea flood is that it doesn't actually recede because the Black Sea is still there. So we don't actually have a kind of recession event. So
yeah.
So I think there are some problems with the Black Sea flood. So sure, you can say that local doesn't mean small. The problem is giving that some kind of application to the regional archaeology and trying to sort of make that make sense. You can't have a devastating, widespread but local flood that doesn't leave physical evidence. I mean, that is just a contradiction in terms. So. Yeah. So that's a problem. Todd, what about this claim that even a local flood can be anthropologically universal? In other words, it can affect all of humans, all of humanity.
Yeah.
I know you've done a lot of work sort of thinking about this question. So is that true?
I'm really hostile to that claim. But it depends on some things. And so I want to be fair about this. So one of the things that it depends on is the timeline, right? So if you're advocating the local flood just on a lark and you don't really care about chronology, this is going to be less compelling. But if you're advocating the local flood because you think that's going to help us make peace with geology, this is where I have a problem, because you're basically going to say, okay, there was a flood sometime early in human history when all humans lived in somewhere in the Near Eastern region, right? Middle East. And that flood wiped out every human being in that region. That's a very common claim of these local flood models. And I don't think that works for a number of reasons. And the biggest reason I have against that is that we have Homo sapiens already distributed on multiple continents. By the time you reach the point in history when, say, Mesopotamia becomes a hub of human settlement and activity. So, for example, we have, and some of these are going to be somewhat disputed, but we have Qassem Cave in Israel, which is said to contain human remains from 400 to 200,000 years ago. We have Jebel Arud from Morocco, which is on Africa. That's 300,000 years ago. Apodima Cave in Greece, which is 215,000 years ago. Omo Kibish in Ethiopia, which is 200,000 years ago. Herto in Ethiopia, which is 150,000 years ago. Kafsa and Skul, both in Israel, 80 to 120,000 years ago, and so forth. And what we think of as the Neolithic revolution in Mesopotamia, that's about 10,000 years ago. So you can see we have evidence of Homo sapiens in places other than Mesopotamia well before this notion of the global flood happens. And it's three continents. We have them in Africa and Ethiopia and Morocco. We have them in Europe and Greece. We have them in Asia, in Israel, and so forth. So that becomes a problem to me. Now, the classic answer, of course, would be to dispute whether those are really human remains. But I just find that rather unsatisfactory because it strikes me that the disputation is merely motivated by the desire to discount the evidence of global human settlement before you can have a flood to flood them all in the Middle East. And that also runs up against, you know, the genetic evidence as well, which would suggest that humans, have a very different history than, you know, being created in Mesopotamia and spreading out from that one region and then getting hit by a giant flood and then recovering. And that's all, again, this is all assuming a conventional mindset. It is not, I am not here claiming that those fossils are really that old or that these things, in a creationist mindset, we're going to reinterpret those as post-flood things, and it's not going to be the same. But if I enter into the local flood mindset, I see that it already has problems of consistency within it, right? You've mentioned one that there really doesn't seem to be a clear layer that is the flood anywhere that we can find in that region of the Middle East. And here we have an example where I don't know how you kill all human beings at the time frame that is most likely to be able to do that, unless you want to stretch, you know, push the flood way back to, like, you know, a million years ago or something. But there is a much bigger problem, I think, and that is that the animals. So we might quibble and argue and dispute about whether there are human beings all isolated in the Middle East or whether they've already globally distributed. But you definitely have animals that are globally distributed. And so you cannot kill all the birds and the creeping things and the wild animals and the beasts of the field. You can't kill them all with a local flood, because they're everywhere. They're all over the planet. And you might say, well, maybe it's referring to the livestock. But again, I'm gonna push back on that, because that's not what the text actually says. It deliberately mentions in 721, it talks about the birds and the wild animals and the creeping things and so forth. So we've gone from just saying maybe the text is hyperbolic to now, well, maybe the text is using words that just mean the local animals, even though it says all the animals everywhere that had the breath of life died. And so now we're really beginning to, once again, you're stretching the text of the Bible against a history, the conventional history that just doesn't fit. So what's another point that he makes in this video?
Yeah, so another point that Gavin wants to emphasize is that a local flood can still be historical And I think he's concerned, you know, that some people just want to say, oh, you're just some kind of theological liberal and you don't really think there ever was a flood. Yeah. You know, he wants to emphasize, no, I think this is real history. You know, and that's fair enough. You know, as an evangelical, you know, that's, we all think that this is, you know, this is real history. So, but I think what he's doing there, this is not a point that is being made in favor of the local flood. It's simply kind of responding to people who might misunderstand what Gavin himself is, you know, he is trying to claim, you know, what his position is. So it's not really a you know, an argument for a local flood. And I think in many ways, the historicity of the flood counts against a local flood for reasons that we've already talked about. The fact that you can't have a historical flood, which is anthropologically universal. We don't have a historical flood that has left an obvious flood layer, you know, in the region where we ought to find it. So that makes historicity quite difficult to argue, I think. So that's one other point that he makes. Now, his next point is one that we've already sort of discussed, which is that the language used in the flood account doesn't have to be understood in a universal sense, yeah. Doesn't have to be understood as global. And as you've already pointed out, it's certainly true that some of the words and phrases and expressions that are used in that text are used elsewhere in Scripture in a less than universal sense. They can be used hyperbolically. So we read, for example, that all the earth came to Egypt, you know, at the time of the famine to get grain. Or Gavin mentions in 1 Kings 10, verse 24, the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon. You know, we're not to understand that, you know, people from Britain came to see Solomon and that
right,
kind of
right, right.
So that's all fair enough. And I think we you know, concede that that is true. The problem is, I think those examples are not equivalent to what we see in Genesis 6 to 9, because, you know, if you read through that text, again, we've said this before, it's that repeated emphasis, the repetition, the fact of the same truth being stated positively and negatively. You know, it's being stated in such a way with such emphasis and repetition that I think isolated verses where the word all or the whole earth is used in a less than universal sense simply are not equivalent to what we see in the flood account. So sure, I think we can concede the point that Gavin makes, but actually I don't think it really is relevant to the flood account.
Right. So the next two points that he makes are also things that we've already mentioned before, so I'm going to just skim through this really quickly. Talks about the promises from after the flood, and he says these could apply universally if the flood was universal with respect to humans. So I will never kill you all with a flood again. Yes, that could still apply, and it could still be kept. The tricky bit that I have with that is that the text clearly says that God will never destroy the ground again, which is not that God will never kill people again. It's that God will never destroy the ground again. And so if you think the ground does not mean the globe, but just refers to certain amount of land, now you're getting back to the question of, well, how much land is necessary to be destroyed by a flood before God has broken his promise. And right. Now I feel like a Pharisee quibbling about, you know, how much should I tithe my spices that grow on my windowsill or whatever. That's lawyer argument. I don't want to get into that. I'm not a lawyer. Another point he makes, that the world in 2 Peter 3, that was destroyed by the flood refers to humanity and not to physical geography. Yes, except that in that passage, the flood is paralleled with creation and the new creation, which are both global events. So it'd be weird if you had a, you know, creation global event local flood, and then new creation, global event. That seems to be, in order to be theologically consistent across the whole point, that you'd want to be, you'd want to be consistent. Because otherwise you'd have, you know, a local creation, which is weird, but has been proposed before. We'll link to that in the show notes. John Pye Smith suggested there was a local creation. I don't think anybody really wants to do.
No. No, but it seems almost the logical outworking of the local flood idea. If the flood is the undoing of the creation, and the flood was only local, then you kind of, you know, you're almost bound to sort of infer a local creation event, which is what John Pye Smith did. But of course, you know, not many people want to go there, so for obvious reasons. So there are some other points that we need to think about that sort of came up in Gavin's video. One concern that he has, and he sort of dwells on this quite a bit, is he's concerned that if you accept a universal flood, then you've got to multiply miracles that go anything beyond what the text actually says. And he seems quite concerned about that. This isn't really a kind of positive argument for the local flood view. It's more a kind of reason to sort of reject the view that we would hold. I suppose the problem I have here is that clearly the flood was a miraculous event. I mean, clearly it was a judgment of God, an intervention into, if you like, the natural order, to cause the flood as a means of judging the world at that time. And so why would we have to assume that everything about the flood was therefore naturalistic? Why would we in effect multiply naturalism concerning the flood?
Right.
So I think the more relevant question would be, what's the best explanation of all the evidence, the textual evidence and the physical evidence taken together?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a better sort of question to ask. So I'm not persuaded by this. And going beyond the text, well, we all go beyond the text because the text gives us bare bones details.
Yep.
And then, you know, we can infer other things from physical evidence. I don't think that's illegitimate to do that. Another point that he sort of brings up concerns flood legends, and he makes the point that flood legends point to the historicity of the flood, which is certainly true. We'd agree with that. I would say, though, that the flood legends argument works at least as well for the global flood view. In fact, I think it works better in the global flood view, because we don't only have flood traditions in the ancient Near East, which is presumably where, you know, a local flood would have happened. But we have flood traditions in Asia and Europe and the Americas and even a few in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you could really explain those, if they are truly traditions of a, you know, memories of a real event, is if the flood was anthropologically universal. And as we've already said, there are big problems in trying to have an anthropologically universal local flood. That only works, I think, in a worldwide flood context. And then one other point he kind of raises is he wants to emphasize that believing in a local flood does not put him outside the bounds of orthodoxy. This is an allowable option for faithful Christians. And again, you know, I think we would agree. We can all be wrong about lots of things in the Bible. We may think that the local flood view is wrong. I don't think either of us are saying that we think that puts Gavin Ortland somehow outside the evangelical camp or outside the bounds of orthodoxy.
No.
All of us, I'm sure, can be wrong about all kinds of things to do with the Bible and theology and other things. And it doesn't make us sort of somehow less Christian. We are still Christians, even if we sometimes get things wrong. So so that's all that we're saying. We disagree with him on the local flood, but we don't want to sort of un-Christian him.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a super important point, because we're human beings. We have a very limited view, and every one of us is wrong about a lot of our theology. I'm sorry, all of you theologians out there, but it is necessary that there's, you know, certain things I agree we've pretty much settled, and it's the best fit to the Bible, and it's the best fit to logic and rationality. Yes, I'll agree with that, but there's a lot of detail in a lot of theologies that are probably just going to end up being wrong. And God's mercy covers that. It's the beautiful thing about it, that we can all be wrong about things, because it's not about passing a theology test in order to get into God's kingdom and into heaven. It is about Jesus' blood. And so it is grace and mercy. It is not based on your grade.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad people don't unchristian me because of, you know, things that they disagree with me about. So absolutely.
So
Todd, where do we go from here? Having thought about some of these points.
You know, the conundrum here, what it leaves us with is a situation of discomfort, I think, for everybody. So on the young age creation side, which is my side, I find great comfort and excitement in exploring geology from the perspective of trying to understand how the flood interacts with the geological record. I think that's pretty exciting. But I understand that some people are going to find that to be a very uncomfortable position to have, that would produce a lot of anxiety. How can I watch National Geographic? I have to reject everything they say. And I think you don't have to reject everything they say, but okay. I get it. You have anxiety about that. But the issue I have with the local flood model that is, and this is, again, I'm not talking necessarily to Gavin, but it's across the board is what I've observed. There tends to be this sense that the local flood alleviates the tension of the conundrum, that if you accept the local flood, then you can accept the old earth, you can accept the conventional timeline, and you can still have an actual historical massive catastrophe just as the Bible describes. You can have it all. And I don't think it does that. And that's my beef with it. It does not do what it advertises. Doesn't live up to the hype. So you end up with, I think, a rather uncomfortable fit with the text. I don't think it's as easy as just saying these words are used hyperbolically. I think there's more to the globalness of the flood than just that. I think that the idea that this just fits right in with geology and archaeology, maybe, probably not. You still have to address these questions of science and anthropology and paleoanthropology and archaeology, and where is the flood, and what is it that you think actually, you know, in the ancient Near East, wherever it is, where is this flood? And yeah, so I guess on our side, we also have people who are very loud about how, you know, the global flood explains it all and there's no evidence for anybody else's position. I find all of those kinds of claims to be unsatisfactory. The conundrum of the flood exists. It's real. That's why we keep training up young creation geologists to keep exploring these things. Now, I suppose you could argue that we should just be, you know, agnostic about, you know, the local flood person might just say, well, maybe we haven't found the layer that is the flood yet, or maybe we haven't, you know, we have good reasons to think those human remains from three different continents before the time of the Neolithic Revolution, those aren't really human after all, or some other thing. And I feel like, yeah, sure, but you're getting to the point of just hand waving at that point. You're not actually providing a good explanation for data. You're providing a good, you're trying to provide an explanation for why there is no data. And I don't like that. I would rather us just get out there and dig in and resolve these questions. Now, again, emphasizing here, this is not a matter of heresy. This doesn't put anybody outside the church or outside the reach of God's grace or any nonsense like that. But yeah, I think it should spur us on to go deeper into these questions, which is why, as I already mentioned, I'm kind of making notes for a follow-up episode here where we're going to look at Mesopotamian floods, because it turns out there's a massive literature on this already out there. People have got all sorts of great scientific papers that have been looking at these things, and I think that's pretty cool. But as far as I can tell already, the local flood view just doesn't do what it says, and I don't think it's a very good fit to scripture. It doesn't do what it says scientifically, and it's not a very good fit to scripture, and so I'm not a fan.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't do what it says on the tin.
Yeah.
And I think that's basically the conclusion that we've both come to. Now, as we said at the outset, you know, we appreciate Gavin's cordiality in dealing with, you know, these issues of disagreement. And I don't know, I'm speaking for myself here, I don't know about you, Todd, but I would love to have a good-natured conversation with Gavin about these kinds of questions. I'm pretty sure he doesn't watch our podcast, but if he does get to hear this podcast, if he does get to see it, then we would love to sort of to do that, to make that conversation happen. And so yeah, reach out to us. That would be fantastic. Okay, that's been fun. I think the local flood, as you said at the outset, is a really interesting topic in and of its own right. So I will come back to it. And the Mesopotamian flood idea and the Black Sea flood, you know, all of those are really interesting topics. And we'll come back to those in future episodes. But for now, that's it. We will see you next time in a couple of weeks, and we hope you'll join us then.
See you later.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let's Talk Creation. For more information, visit us at letstalkcreation.org, where you'll find an archive of past episodes and all our show notes. If you'd like to leave a comment or make a suggestion, you can find us on all the major social media platforms. Let's Talk Creation is brought to you in the U.S. by Core Academy of Science and in the U.K. by Biblical Creation Trust. As a listener-supported ministry, we are grateful for all of your financial support. Find out how you can make a contribution at our website, letstalkcreation.org. Also remember to like, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends. Thanks, and see you next time.